Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. Welcome to The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, an Arizona Supreme Court justice says he's worried about what he sees as attacks on judicial independence. And what does it take to be Arizona's new poet laureate? But first, President Trump signed the so-called Big Beautiful Bill on July 4th. It includes many of his policy priorities, including more money for immigration enforcement and making permanent tax cuts approved during his first term. The bill, though, also has several provisions dealing with health care. Medicaid work requirements have gotten the most attention, but as NPR reports, there could also be implications for rural hospitals and Americans with health care plans through the Affordable Care Act. So how will this new law impact Arizona and the state's Medicaid program known as Access? With me now to talk about that is Megan Kramer, health policy advisor to Governor Katie Hobbs. Megan, good morning.
Good morning.
So what is the biggest, I guess, potential implication to Arizona from this new law?
Well, there's a few things. The first is really Arizona's healthcare system, like all healthcare systems, is this very complicated ecosystem. And it's made up of programs that are funded by the federal government, the state government. We have Medicare, Medicaid, the ACA, which is the Affordable Care Act marketplace, and then folks who are on employer-sponsored health insurance. And the changes in this bill will really disrupt many portions of that in a few ways. The first is there will be the provider tax is something that I think most folks coming into this bill season didn't really know much about.
Yeah.
But it's a complex financing mechanism that for more than 40 years has helped fund rural hospitals in Arizona. And, some of the urban hospitals receive significant payments through this mechanism as well. I think one of the main things to understand is the provider tax is just a way to help supplement the payments that come into these hospitals because so many Medicaid people are being served and the payments that they're billing for Medicaid services are not enough to make up for the costs that it costs these hospitals to provide Medicaid services. So the bill reduces over several years this financing mechanism, and as a result, many hospitals are going to suffer in Arizona and primarily the rural hospitals.
I mentioned work requirements for Medicaid. Arizona, of course, has a law on the books that requires the state to ask the federal government for permission to implement something like that. There's been a lot of talk about people potentially falling off the Medicaid rolls because they don't meet the requirements or due to sort of paperwork issues. Are you anticipating that there will be fewer people on Medicaid at some point in the not too distant future?
The work requirements, as they will apply to the expansion population, there's a number of things in this bill that are going to cause people to fall off the rolls. And Arizona, for a long time, has had a requirement to ask for permission from CMS to implement a work requirement. We did do that this year, but we wanted to do it in a way that made sense for Arizona, that provided lots of exceptions and that made sure that people who were too sick to work did not have to work. The federal requirement that was passed in this bill is very rigid, and as a result, that plus frequent redetermination requirements, making sure that people are still eligible.
Mm-hmm.
Mainly, it's just paperwork. That's the reason people are going to fall off the rolls. There are 500,000 people right now who are Medicaid expansion folks in Arizona, and we're estimating that as many as 220,000 of them could
almost half.
Yeah, could lose their health insurance. I do want to emphasize it's going to be a little while before these get implemented. And so there's been a lot of talk of deep cuts to Medicaid. We want to make sure that if you receive documentation from Access or from Medicare or whoever to fill out your paperwork with respect to redetermination, keep filling that out. The cuts have not taken place yet, and we want to make sure that people stay on the rolls as long as they can.
So if 220,000-some-odd Medicaid recipients lose that coverage, presumably some, if not most of them, will be uninsured, What does that mean for hospitals and other providers in the state who will be, especially the hospitals who are required to treat patients, whether or not they get paid for it?
Yeah, that's the thing is no matter how much we cut, the same number of people are going to get sick and they're going to have chronic illness and disabilities that will require a very expensive care. So the numbers of uncompensated cases that each of these hospitals are going to have to take care of will just continue to go up. Hospitals are required to treat whoever comes in their emergency room doors. And these cuts will just increase that burden. That care is also another big reason why we passed the Affordable Care Act is uncompensated care causes people to seek emergency care, which is much more expensive. And the preventative care that people would get through Medicaid, through the Affordable Care Act, that stuff's going to be gone. And they're going to be seeking the most expensive care imaginable, which is going to put a huge burden on hospitals. And we just anticipate that compounding with the provider tax, which could cause a significant number of hospitals to close their doors, it could be a real nightmare for services in Arizona.
Would you imagine that the biggest hit will be to hospitals in rural parts of Arizona?
Yes, absolutely. We had earlier this year the provider tax financing mechanism that we spoke about earlier. Those payments had been delayed from CMS. And just because the payments had been delayed, we had a significant number of hospitals in Arizona who were desperate, who were drawing up plans if they didn't make payroll, who were contemplating closing labor and delivery units. And those were just a couple of missed payments from CMS. And so we do anticipate that this could be very devastating to our rural communities in particular.
All right. Lots more to follow on this for sure. That is Megan Kramer, health policy advisor to Governor Katie Hobbs. Megan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Arizona Supreme Court Justice Clint Bowlick is speaking out about what he calls deeply disturbing attacks on the judicial branch in this country. And those attacks, he says, are largely coming from the Trump administration. The Arizona Republic first reported on Bowlick's comments to a legal organization called the Society for the Rule of Law, a right-of-center group. The justice then expanded on those comments, criticizing what he sees as threats to due process and judicial independence. Justice Bowlick joins me now to talk more about this. Justice Bowlick, good morning. Thanks for being here.
It's always great to be with you. Thank you.
So what prompted you to speak out? I mean, this is I know that, you know, judges and justices especially are often loath to sort of speak out on issues that are even perceived as political.
Well, you know what? I got my training wheels last year during my own judicial retention election when a number of folks this time from the left. We're challenging my colleague, Justice Kate King, and me for a decision with which they disagreed and trying to remove us from office during the retention election. And I argued that an independent judiciary requires that people judge judges based on their merits and their performance, not on the positions that they rule on. And then no sooner did Justice King and I get retained, then a whole new episode began, this time from the right. And the Trump administration has taken unprecedented, I wouldn't say steps so much, but certainly has engaged in rhetoric that I have never heard before. And certain actions have been taken, such as the deputy chief of staff threatening to suspend habeas corpus, which dates back to the Magna Carta, if the courts don't do the right thing, to use his words, efforts to impeach judges over decisions that they have taken. And I think judges really need to stand up for the independent judiciary. There's no one that we can look to that we can count on to defend the independent judiciary more aggressively than judges themselves.
Have you seen any changes as a result of this kind of rhetoric? Like, do you find that it's having an impact on judges and maybe the way that they rule on cases?
Well, certainly, you know, fortunately, the framers did build in a mechanism to prevent having judges, federal judges, look over their shoulders, and that is lifetime tenure, and that's why impeachment threats are so concerning. But I certainly can't point to a particular decision and say that judge ruled that way because he or she was nervous. But it can't help but have that impact to make you think twice about a ruling if it is going to have consequences for your profession.
What does it mean, do you think, if judges are looking over their shoulder and thinking about, like, the fact that they might lose their job if they rule a way that a particular politician or political entity doesn't like?
Well, it means then that the judiciary is in a position to become simply another political branch, an arm of the executive branch. And we see that in most countries around the world. Mexico is the most recent country to essentially politicize its judiciary. It is now an entirely elected judiciary, and it is elected literally alongside the elections for the government. And the idea that that judiciary is going to be bold and independent, you know, is a laughable notion. And in fact, the government proposed this judicial reform to obtain a more compliant judiciary. Here in the United States, it is a touchstone of our constitutional republic that we resolve our disputes not on the streets, but in the courts of law, and that we can trust the courts by and large, with some exceptions, but certainly more than in most countries, to do the right thing, to rule in favor of David over Goliath when David deserves to win, to enforce the law and not to care who is in power.
There has been a lot of talk over the last several months about this idea of, like, what happens if the administration, or really any administration, just ignores a court ruling. And it seems like we've seen maybe sort of baby steps in that direction in terms of maybe delaying or saying, well, we're not sure if we can do this. Like, what to you happens if, let's say, the U.S. Supreme Court or the Arizona Supreme Court issues a ruling and, you know, the administration, either the president or the governor, whomever, says, yeah, I don't think so?
Well, if that were to prevail, and I'm not sure what the courts could do about it, and that, you know, the folks who are advocating this on the outside of the administration certainly recognize that. A guy named Mike Davis, who is very influential on judicial matters with the administration, said that we need to do whatever it takes to hold the sword of Damocles over the judiciary. So I'm not sure exactly what the judiciary can do other than to resort to public opinion. And I think what we saw in the retention election here for myself and Justice King last year was a lot of people. We won retention despite a very strong campaign against us with nearly 60% of the vote. And to me, that was a very strong indication of a popular consensus in favor of an independent judiciary. But the courts themselves are largely powerless. And it almost got worse. A provision in the Big Beautiful Bill that passed the House would largely have taken away the court's contempt power. That is, the power to punish parties and lawyers who disobey court orders. That was in the Senate version. It became a bond requirement for injunctions, which would have required, in many cases, either millions or, in some instances, billions of dollars in bonds before the courts could issue an injunction. Amazingly, that got stripped out of the bill, not because senators said, oh, what are we doing here? But because the Senate parliamentarian stripped it out of the bill. And I was writing about that, and others were trying to draw attention to that. But obviously, there were a lot of provisions in that bill that were controversial. And if it weren't for the Senate parliamentarian, the courts could very well have lost a part of the very limited powers that they have to enforce their opinions.
Oh, that's very interesting. All right. Well, unfortunately, I have to leave it there. Much more to come on this, I'm sure. Arizona Supreme Court Justice Clint Bolick. Justice Bolick, thanks as always. Nice to talk to you.
Likewise. Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how does the state select a new poet laureate, and what does that position really do? We'll hear from the person leading that search. But first, a new political event aimed at Latinos piqued the interest of longtime political strategist Mike Madrid. So he went. CPAC Latino took place in Miami late last month. It's an offshoot of sorts of CPAC, or the Conservative Political Action Committee, which has held popular gatherings for those on the political right for several years. But as Madrid found out, there were some differences between this event and the original. Madrid is a co-host of the Latino Vote podcast and writes The Great Transformation on Substack. He joins me now to talk about what he heard and saw in Miami. Mike, good to hear from you. Thanks.
It's great to be with you. Thank you so much for having me.
So I want to start with a line that you wrote in your Substack, sort of talking about this event. And you write, "This was a sophisticated business crowd looking to network and find value for their enterprises, and they were suckered into a Charlie Kirk podcast." It sounds like there might have been a bit of a discrepancy between what the attendees were hoping to get out of this and what the organizers were expecting to give them. Is that a fair assessment?
That's a perfect encapsulation of what happened. And again, look, I've been involved in both Latino and Republican politics for three decades. So to hear that CPAC was going to be doing something with the Latino community naturally piqued my interest. I'm here in California, in Sacramento. I flew out to Miami, where this would naturally be happening with a large Cuban constituency. Mm-hmm. But there was a tremendous, tremendous disconnect between the normal spectacle you see at CPAC conferences with sort of, you know, red, white, and blue sequins, performances happening in the hallway, the real strong grassroots activists, and what this was, which was much more like a Chamber of Commerce event. People looking, these were established, sophisticated Latino business owners, and what they were being served on stage was sort of the red meat Republican MAGA, propaganda, and the business community just was not having any of it. It was really remarkable.
Well, so what does that tell you, at least about for the folks who attended? I mean, it had CPAC in the name, so I would imagine there was maybe some sense of what they were going to get, but it seems as though that wasn't really what they were there for.
Well, that's exactly right. And I don't want to be entirely dismissive of it, but there were signs, as they say. You know, there was one red MAGA hat out of 700 people. Mm. And this was a Republican, a traditional classic Republican business crowd. It wasn't the MAGA rally. And that's sort of what they were being offered. And I think that the trying to stitch these two together was a sign to these business leaders that the Republican Party was trying to stitch together sort of this entrepreneurial class with the grassroots, and they were more interested in seeing what that was going to look like. Now, keep in mind, this was happening just as the ICE crackdowns were really happening in a very meaningful way in South Florida. So for the first time, you had Cuban emigres and Venezuelan emigres, who were the largest source of Latino support for Donald Trump, suddenly recoiling and saying, wait a second, we didn't think this was going to be happening to us. Mm. And there was no mention in the 2 days about the ICE raids, about deportations, about immigration reform. None of that was focused on. You heard a lot about the Israeli Iranian conflict. You heard a lot about Ukraine and Russia. You heard a lot about foreign policy, but nothing about immigration.
Well, so as you say, it seems like they were the organizers were trying to stitch this together. In that sense, did it seem almost like an experiment to you to see if these similar but in some ways disparate groups could sort of work together?
To me, it was really a broad sign that the challenges afflicting the Democratic Party exist in the Republican Party too, as this Latino electorate emerges and both institutions are struggling to understand how to deal with them. Where the Democrats have a real challenge in getting back to sort of their working class roots and lost a lot of working class, non-college educated Latinos, specifically men, this was a clear sign that Republicans are grappling with the other side of that, which is sort of the college educated, aspirational, entrepreneurial class that has historically been a central piece of its coalition. They're losing these voters because their message is not as resonant. And so in many ways, what I wanted to examine was, one, if this was afflicting both parties, I think that's clear that it is, and then how both parties are going to try to address that. The Republican Party in many ways is becoming what the Democratic Party was in the 1980s, and the Democratic Party is becoming what the Republican Party was in the 1980s. And in the middle is this emergent group of Latinos saying, we don't really feel comfortable with either party here. And again, this event happened on the same day that the Pew Hispanic Research poll came out, or the data from the elections showing basically that Donald Trump got 48% of the vote, almost a 50-50 split.
Yeah.
So this vote is entirely in flux. It's entirely gettable for both parties. But I think both parties really don't understand how they're going to address themselves, their own coalition, and then this fast growing segment of the vote.
So let's at least take the GOP then. Like, how do you think they should be going about building on the gains that President Trump made last year?
Well, the one common thread with Latinos, and we all hear all the time that this is not a monolithic voting group, that there's a lot of diversity. All of that is true. But there is one common thread, and that is it is the fastest growing segment of the blue collar working class voter. And so the party that's able to speak to those blue collar interests and values candidly is going to be the party that's dominant in the for the next generation of American politics. And for the moment, Donald Trump is speaking to that populism. He was speaking to that anti-institutionalism, that neither party is reflecting these views, and it's manifesting itself in things like housing and affordability, the incompetence of government's ability to keep energy prices or grocery prices down. This was real meaningful, impactful messaging during the 2024 election cycle. Democrats have resorted to their part on sort of the immigration narrative that has defined their party's relationship with Latinos since the 1990s. And it seems as though, at least at the moment, because of the overreach of these ICE crackdowns and federal overreach, that you're going to see a pushback, a return of Latino voters back to the Democratic Party in the midterms, but not solving the underlying problem that Democrats have with this emergent voting bloc. So I think what's going to be defining our politics for the next decade, next generation, is going to be the struggle that both parties are facing in encapsulating a true economic populist sentiment, which is really the defining characteristics of the Latino community, not conservatism, not republicanism, not progressivism, and not the Democratic Party, but an anti-institutional economic populist voting group that is unlike anything we've seen in this country's history before.
Well, that is really interesting. All right. That is Mike Madrid, co-host of the Latino Vote podcast, author of The Great Transformation on Substack. Mike, great as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate you.
In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, industry was booming in big cities back east. With the rapid expansion of jobs came a population explosion. In New York City, so many children were being born that families couldn't keep up, and an epidemic of abandoned babies swept through the city. Meanwhile, out here in what wasn't yet Arizona, mining towns were cropping up in remote parts of the country, and the communities lacked the resources to keep babies alive. Census records from the early 1900s contain tragic accounts of households reporting multiple births, but very few surviving children. In the midst of all this, a Catholic charity in New York called the Foundling began running what came to be known as orphan trains. The nuns at the Foundling, known as the Sisters of Charity, worked with these distant mining towns to find families who wanted to adopt abandoned kids from the city and sent those kids out west on trains to start new lives. The program saved many lives, but it also created crises, including a situation in 1904 that's come to be known as the Arizona Incident. Lori Halfhide is a researcher with a historical preservation organization called the National Orphan Train Complex, and she's done extensive work to uncover exactly what happened during the Arizona incident. As she told my co-host Sam Dingman, the whole thing started in a pair of small towns called Clifton and Morenci.
Clifton and Morenci were both mining communities. Each one had about 5,000 people. And of the nearly 10,000 combined residents, two-thirds of those people were Mexican-Americans. The Mexican-Americans were Catholic. The white mine owners and business owners were Protestant. So there was a big rift there. There was also the fact that the year before, the Mexican-Americans had staged a walkout and a strike at the copper mines. And there were still very hard feelings between the mine owners and the Mexican population. And then they got a new priest who came in from France, barely spoke the language. He had no idea what had happened the previous year. And when the foundling contacted him and wanted to see if he had people that wanted kids, everybody there wanted kids.
So this new priest, what did he tell the foundling when they reached out?
He took applications from his parishioners, who were all Mexican Americans, and he contacted the foundling and told them that he had some Hispanic people who wanted to take in children. Well, the sisters immediately thought, oh, these people are from Spain. So they sent lighter complected children because the people from Spain, you know, they tended to be lighter complected. And when they got to Arizona, they made the horrifying discovery that all of these little blonde-haired, red-haired, pale children were being put in Mexican homes. And they could not argue with the priest because, number one, it was 1904 and women couldn't back talk anybody. And number two, they were sisters and they could not say anything that would demean the priest in front of his parishioners.
Wow. So there's a number of dynamics operating in that scene you've just described, it sounds like.
Yeah.
First, there's the gender dynamics that you were just alluding to, the religious dynamics in terms of the dynamic between the nuns and the priest. But also, if I'm hearing you right, Lori, there was a fundamental assumption made by the sisters in New York that they would be sending light-skinned children to live with light-skinned families. And the prospect
yes.
that wasn't going to happen was, in the context of the time, a huge scandal.
Yes. The Protestant women of the community showed up at the train station when they found out that these children were going to be coming into town. They figured they could get some too. They didn't know that they had already been pre-assigned homes.
Right.
So when they got there, they told the nuns they wanted children and they said, well, I'm sorry, we can't give them to you because they're already pre-assigned. And
right.
one of the women just wouldn't take no for an answer. And she's the one who basically started all of the bad stuff that was going to happen.
So let's talk about that bad stuff. Presumably, the majority of the children who arrived that day did end up going to the Mexican-American families, right?
Yes. They had 20 children they were going to leave in Clifton. 20 children were going to be going to Morenci. They made the placements in Clifton, and Sister Anna Michaela, who was in charge, watched the placement go on. She knew that this was not a good situation. She knew that there was going to be trouble, but she couldn't say anything. So the children went home with these families. They went back to the train car where they had the other 20 children. First thing in the morning, they loaded up into a wagon and they went up to Morenci with the other 20 kids. When they got up there, they started placing them out in Morenci. And they placed 14 out, and Sister Anna Michaela refused several of them because she said that there was just too much of a difference between the child and the family. So she was starting to get her courage up and speak up.
But presumably that difference that she was referring to was
skin color.
Was skin color based, yeah.
Yeah.
So then there's more trouble.
Oh, there's lots more trouble. They wound up with a mob in Clifton. And they went around and they picked up all of the kids who had been placed out in Clifton, while the sisters picked up the ones in Morenci. They had decided that this was a bad situation. They were going to pick up the kids and they were going to leave town. Well, they got the kids from Morenci, but they didn't make it back to Clifton in time to get them. The community had already done it.
Do we know how old these children were at the time of these incidents?
Yes. They were all from 2 to 6 years old.
Okay. So
6 was the oldest. Most of them averaged right around 3 to 4.
So these are kids who are already old enough to be forming memories and,
yes,
you know, really experiencing the trauma of this. They've already become orphans in one way or another back in New York. They've now taken this cross-country train trip and been placed with new families and are now being ripped out of the homes of those families by third families.
Yes. They took the kids to the hotel, which was owned by one of the people who was key in starting this whole mob thing. And then in the morning, they held their own placing out. And the owner of the hotel, his wife, gave the kids to all of her friends.
I see. I feel like I read somewhere that part of what led to this mob of white families doing this was that these salacious stories had started appearing in the newspaper about what was happening to the kids, right?
Yes. Word spreads quickly in a little tiny town like that. And when the posse had gone around and picked up these children, they went back and they told all of their friends that these kids, when they picked up these babies, they had beer on their breath and they were in the red light district and they had been found in the homes of prostitutes and their little tummies didn't handle the Mexican food and they were all sick. And it was just completely bogus, made up, just anything that they could do to make the situation look like what they did was the right thing.
Yeah. So what happened after the kids were rehomed for the second time?
It eventually wound up in the Arizona Supreme Court, and then it went on, the sisters appealed, and it went on to the National Supreme Court.
So what did the Supreme Court end up deciding?
That the foundling had no claim to the children and that the families that they were living with could keep them.
So the Mexican-American families who had originally offered their homes to these kids got
nothing. Yeah.
So why do you think it's important for this incident, which, as I understand it, is not very widely known, to be talked about?
I think it's important to remember all of the orphan train news and the things that happened with these children, because basically this was the beginning of the foster care system. And it needs to be remembered. We need to remember our past so that we can fix it and, you know, hopefully do better in the future.
Well, Lori Halfhide is head researcher at the National Orphan Train Complex. Lori, thank you so much for telling us this story.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. This Wednesday marks a deadline in President Trump's effort to impose tariffs on countries around the globe importing goods into the U.S. Earlier this year, Trump announced and then quickly paused a range of tariffs on a number of countries, giving them until July 9th to agree to new trade deals. With me for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Jonathan Frewin in London. And Jonathan, what's likely to happen after that Wednesday deadline?
Well, you may remember that members of the Trump cabinet promised that there would be 90 deals in 90 days when Donald Trump paused what he called reciprocal tariffs that he'd announced a week earlier that were to be imposed on countries all over the world, as you say. But there's not been a great deal of progress on trade deals since then. There was one high-profile deal announced from the White House between the US and the UK, introducing a quota on UK car imports with reduced tariffs on vehicles imported up to the quota in exchange for US access to UK markets for bioethanol and beef from the US, and supposedly eliminating fighting tariffs on imports of steel from the UK, though the metals element is still being negotiated. And there has been some progress with China, largely as a result of Beijing imposing restrictions on the exports of rare earth metals to the United States, which many industries rely heavily on to make their goods. That focused minds in Washington, and terms were reached in talks between the US and China in London last month. Last week, the US president announced a deal with Vietnam, whereby a 20% tariff would be applied to US imports from there, with tariffs lifted by Vietnam on American goods. And the Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, says that his inbox is full of last-ditch offers from countries around the world, and announcements are expected in the coming couple of days. Now, Donald Trump has said that he doesn't intend to extend the deadline beyond Wednesday, and he said that he's sending letters to around a dozen or so trading partners today, with new terms to be imposed from August the 1st. So if he follows through and reimposes tariffs, that could have significant consequences.
What might some of those consequences be?
Well, let's look at the impact that tariffs have had on the US economy so far. One, the biggest tariffs were announced in early April. The S&P 500 market, which obviously tracks 500 of the biggest companies in the US, dropped by about 12% over the course of a week. Shares bounced back after the tariff announcement was paused, but if they're reintroduced this week, it could significantly impact US stock markets. Then there's the question of the impact of tariffs on inflation. Imported goods in the US are estimated to account for only about 11% of consumer spending. So Donald Trump and his allies argue that fears tariffs will drive up the cost of living for Americans are overblown. But some items, such as toys, have seen substantial price increases. And despite pressure from the president for retailers to, quote, eat the tariffs, economists still widely expect customers to pay for them eventually. And consumer spending has also slowed, which some economists attribute to the impact of tariffs.
So, Jonathan, let's move now to Poland, which today is introducing border controls on its border with Germany. What's the background on this?
Well, the first thing to say is that Poland and Germany are both members of the European Union, which in theory should leave the border between the two countries open. But back in May, Germany imposed border controls at its borders in a bid to reject undocumented migrants, including those looking to claim asylum in Germany. It's seen as likely a violation of EU asylum rules, so there's an element of tit for tat to all this. But the impetus here is also coming from an attempt by Poland to stem illegal migration. Prime Minister Donald Tusk's Liberal government has been accused by nationalist opposition parties of accepting numerous illegal migrants being sent back from Germany. The government, for its part, has argued that the numbers are limited. Meanwhile, debate over migration in Poland has turned increasingly heated in recent weeks, with far-right activists starting to organise patrols at the border with Germany. Donald Tusk has said, quote, "We consider the temporary reintroduction of controls necessary to reduce the uncontrolled flows of migrants across the Polish-German border to a minimum."
And what has Germany had to say about all this?
Well, Germany's recently appointed Chancellor Friedrich Merz said last week that Germany wants to preserve the so-called Schengen open border scheme, which allows for passport-free movement. But he added that this could only work if it was not abused by criminals who smuggle migrants. He told a news conference, "We know the Polish government also wants to impose border controls with Lithuania in order to limit illegal border crossings from Lithuania to Poland," adding, "We have a common problem here that we want to solve together." Part of the context here is a ruling by Berlin's administrative court last month in a case brought by three Somali asylum seekers who had arrived in Frankfurt from Poland in May and were returned to Poland the same day. The court ruled that the asylum seekers' claim should have been examined in Germany first. The Germany-Poland situation speaks to a wider context across Europe, where 11 EU countries are currently checking documents at their internal Schengen borders, including France, Austria and the Netherlands. So it's a fairly delicate situation and definitely one to watch as it develops.
Yeah, sure sounds like it. All right, so Jonathan, finally for this week, a very interesting auction going on in London this week, a love letter from John Lennon to his future wife.
That's right. A 21-year-old John Lennon wrote the letter to his future wife, Cynthia, over five nights in April 1962 during the Beatles' residency at the Star Club in Hamburg. "I love, love, love you, and I'm missing you like mad," he said. Now, the letter is expected to fetch up to around $55,000 when it goes on sale at the auction house Christie's on Wednesday. John Lennon also mentions his close friend and the original Beatles bassist, Stuart Sutcliffe, who had died just days before, saying he had considered visiting his fiancée Astrid, but adding, "I would be so awkward."
And am I right? There's also a reference in this letter to Paul McCartney snoring?
Yeah, that's right. John Lennon complained about his bandmate's bedtime habits, writing, "Paul's leaping about on my head. He's in a bunk on top of me and he's snoring," imploring him to shut up. John Lennon signed off the letter, "I love you, please wait for me, and don't be sad and work hard." Now, Cynthia Powell had dated Lennon from 1958, and they got married in August 1962, giving birth to their son Julian in April 1963. They divorced 5 years after that, and a year later, John Lennon married Yoko Ono. So this is quite a piece of Beatles memorabilia for people who might be interested in that sort of thing.
Yeah, sure is. All right, that is the BBC's Jonathan Frewin in London. Jonathan, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Good to talk to you too.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Arizona is in the process of looking for a new poet laureate. Alberto Rios was the first person to serve in that role. His term, though, ended last year. Anna Needham is tribal relations manager at the Arizona Commission on the Arts and is leading the effort to find the new poet laureate. A new one should be selected by this fall. She says the job is about being able to get out to different parts of the state, teach people about poetry, and develop new poems for events like Statehood Day, among other components. I spoke with Needham about this, and we started with how the commission goes about finding a new poet laureate.
It's a pretty long process just because we want to be thoughtful about it. We're being tasked for this as the commission. We are making a process where it's first an open call. And so folks across Arizona were able to nominate members of the public, but also those who are part of colleges and universities, those who are part of literary groups across the state, able to share either nominating themselves or nominating others who they felt fit this position, who have that kind of high quality caliber of work and the ability to engage with communities across Arizona.
Are you getting a lot of applications?
Yes, we actually received 31 nominations that then became 21 nominees. So there were folks who were nominated multiple times. And so from that, our group of panelists actually determined 7 folks who would then go on to provide more information and know that they were nominated and give us the ability to understand their full work.
So what criteria were you looking at when you narrowed it down from 21 to 7?
Right. So we were looking at criteria that was both based off what, you know, was established with this position originally, as well as part of the governor's priorities. And so this is somebody who we were looking at who had experience with engaging with communities and writing poetry from community input. We were looking for folks who did have published work and bios and resumes who really showcased that they had that kind of longevity to their work. We were looking at who could be able to actually take on that position, especially since it involves a lot of travel.
Like logistically, who had time
yes,
to do it?
Yes, like who has time for this? Who is somebody who has a track record of being able to put out these things? Because, it, you know, we don't want to have somebody who can't commit to doing this type of work for Arizona. We want to make sure it's the best person for the job.
What's the timeline in terms of having a new poet laureate in place?
So the next poet laureate term starts in mid-January. So that is the timeline set in statute. With what we're doing, basically mid-August is when panelists will get together, figure out the final 3 that will then be sent to the governor's office, who in statute has 60 days to finalize an appointment. And then from there, we will connect with them and then help them start their first term in January of 2026.
So the governor will ultimately pick the new person.
Yes.
I'm so interested about the idea that poetry, like I suppose any form of writing, is so subjective, right? Like,
absolutely.
Is it good? Is it meaningful? Does it speak to you in a certain way? Like, how do you sort of grade or judge that? Because however many people are on the panel, like, everyone's going to come at it with their own experience and sort of have their own opinions about it.
Yeah, no, I think that's the thing with arts in general, right, where it's so subjective.
Yeah.
Where, you know, we focus as an agency rather in artistic strength. Are they able to explain their practice? Are they able to connect with folks? It's less about, you know, what preferences you have. And we discuss that with panelists of you may have a certain type of art form because you're so ingrained in that community. But these are peer artists who understand the landscape of Arizona's literary community. They understand what it means to create poetry. And if this person is sharing, this is my process of creating poetry and how I see it can benefit this position as poet laureate, that informs the panelists on whether or not that they fit this position.
So to some extent, is it almost less about what they're saying in their poetry and more about how they come up with it and how they're able to explain it and maybe to an extent even defend it?
Yeah, it's a thing about being able to create work that's impactful, but also explain, you know, literary devices and be able to, because this position is about empowering other folks and being able to have them be interested in creating their own poetry and being able to have self-expression, even if it's not something that necessarily they would consider good, right? Like, from whatever standards you're using. What it is about is being able to inspire folks to actually do that expression and being able to do it in a way that, you know, brings learning for folks. Are they able to actually not just necessarily create work, but be able to inspire other work to come forth?
I wanted to ask you about the education component, because I'm wondering how much of this job is about going into schools, going into adult writing groups, or just any community and exposing people to poetry who maybe haven't heard or read a lot of it and trying to get them excited about either doing their own or listening to it elsewhere?
Yeah, that's an explicit part of that work, where it's about, we actually have it where we're asking them every 3 months to go to one specific rural community and probably do more 2 to 3 is what we're really want, to be able to do those types of things where it can be hosted at community centers or boys and girls clubs and have maybe an open mic night. Or we're trying to do these things of hearing from these communities, you know, for example, what's one word that you feel like sums up your community? And from that, be able to have all that input become a poem that then can be made into a print, for example, that then one goes back to the community who provided that type of information, and then one can go to the governor to display.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Is there a component of this job where the person really needs to sort of have an understanding of Arizona itself?
Yes. It is very much a thing of, if you don't know Arizona, you at least have to be enthusiastic about that. It's both enthusiasm about poetry and then enthusiasm about Arizona, because you will be in this official position, right? Where it's like, if you're not interested in Arizona, you shouldn't be representing Arizona.
Well, and to an extent, like, the poetry kind of has to represent the state too. Like, you kind of, I would imagine it would be helpful to sort of have an understanding of like what this place is all about and what issues there are and what makes it tick and what its history looks like, that kind of
thing. Yes, absolutely.
All right. That is Anna Needham, Tribal Relations Manager with the Arizona Commission on the Arts. Anna, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Thanks, as always, for being along. A reminder, you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It is called Radioheads. You can do that at theshow.kjzz.org. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram at @KJZZTheShow. For Sam Dingman and Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a great rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.